You are listening to Radio Region. This is Saturday Morning Live. My name is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali. And we are back with Dr. Gerald Horn for the first time in many, many moons. How are you doing, my good friend?
Fine. And yourself?
I'm good. How is the sound? Can you hear us?
Loud and clear.
Beautiful. Now, before we really get started, I basically wanted to say that I understand. I know you have the new book out on William Patterson. We did an interview about that on Uhuru Radio. But I understand you had a huge audience both in Washington, D.C. and in Esalen. I think the bookstore that you spoke at in Washington was called Sankofa, if I'm not mistaken, a coffee shop, and it's owned by some Ethiopians, if I'm not mistaken.
You are correct.
And how has the reaction of the book been? When is the New York Times and the Financial Times going to review it?
Well, don't hold your breath with regard to that. but, you know, who knows? Stranger things have happened.
But could you just briefly tell me, we talked about the book on Uhuru Radio, but William Patterson, for those listening to Radio Regent who have no idea of who William Patterson was, could you give us an outline on William Patterson? I know I had a book, his autobiography was called The Man Who Cried Genocide, but I'll let you elaborate.
Well, that's correct. And what I'll do is seize the opportunity to segue into talking about his good friend Paul Robeson and then move from there onto the Ukraine, which is rapidly spinning out of control as we speak. Patterson was a black communist lawyer born in San Francisco in 1891, dies in 1980. In between was the leader of the International Labor Defense, which spearheaded the campaign against the prosecution and maltreatment and proposed execution of nine black youth in Alabama who were charged falsely with sexual molestation of two Euro-American women. And I argue in the book that it sets the stage for the retreat of Jim Crow in the United States and North America generally, and not least because there was an international campaign generated against the system. And then to fast forward into the early 1950s, it was he and Paul Robeson who filed a petition with the United Nations charging the U.S. rulers with genocide against people of African descent. Now, since Paul Robeson in passing, his finger of accusation is wagging on the cover of the We Charge Genocide book. And Paul Robeson, as you know, was a friend of the former Soviet Union. And also, in going through his papers, which I'm doing now because I'm in Washington where I'm working on a biography of Paul Robeson, you may recall that he spent a considerable amount of time in the Ukraine and spoke in some of the materials that I examined about Ira Aldrich, the great 19th century black interpreter of Othello and Shakespeare generally, who went into exile in Europe and, in fact, died in Poland, and was a good friend of Taras Shevchenko, who in many ways is the father of Ukrainian language, just like Alexei Pushkin, who was of African descent, was the father of the Russian language. And Robeson wrote quite movingly about that particular relationship. And also,
you're listening to, you are cracking, Gerald. I cannot hear you.
Enter your destination number now.
We have lost Dr. Horn. We will be right back. And you are listening to Saturday Morning Live. I'm back on the line with Dr. Gerald Horn. You were speaking about Mr. Robeson's work in the Ukraine and comparing the I guess, African-Ukrainian to Mr. Dumas or Pushkin, pardon me, in Russia.
No, I was comparing Ira Aldrich, the great 19th century interpreter
of Shakespeare.
To Robeson, the great 20th century interpreter of Othello, and our audience's relationship with the Ukrainian, not Afro-Ukrainian, poet and father of Ukrainian language, Taras Shevchenko. But the main point is that this crisis that's unfolding as we speak, where the United States administration came into power talking about a reset with Moscow so they could pivot towards China. To that end, you know that relations between China and Japan have deteriorated of late, and we know that the United States has established a base in northern Australia to target China. And some of us are scratching our heads wondering how this crisis in the Ukraine fits with the overall strategy, because in some ways the U.S. and NATO are like the dog that catches the car. I mean, they've basically effectively destabilized Ukraine and have prevented the Yanukovych government, the recently deposed government, from effectuating an entente with Moscow or a bailout package with Moscow. But the North Atlantic powers do not want to put forward an adequate bailout package, and nor do they really want a military confrontation with Moscow. Not only that, but if you look at the forces that deposed the Yanukovych government, it includes many unsavory elements. The Svoboda Party, which is now part of the current so-called government, is a right-wing, some might even call it neo-fascist party. Then there's the Right Sector organization, which stands to the right of Svoboda. And so this situation is very dangerous, and Moscow is interpreting it in a very as being a dangerous situation because, as you know, during World War II, Russia suffered grievously from fascist incursions, and Russia noted with some alarm when the forces that deposed the Yanukovych government, one of the first things they did was to topple World War II memorials and anti-fascist memorials. And this is quite alarming, I must say. And of late, you know that in the Crimea to the south of Ukraine, there have been reports of Russians. It's unclear if they're directed from Moscow, who have deposed the pro-Kiev, that is to say the new government forces. And apparently, at least according to the U.S. press, there is a move afoot to detach the Crimea from the Ukraine, not unlike what happened in 2008 in the wake of the Olympics in China when Russian forces invaded Georgia. And the end result was detaching Abkhazia and Ossetia from Georgia. It's clear that the United States and Canada and the North Atlantic countries are very upset with Mr. Putin about Syria, about Iran, and it's clear that they would like a sellout regime in Moscow, like that symbolized by Boris Yeltsin, who Putin replaced. But it doesn't look like that's going to happen anytime soon. And I think one of the more unfortunate aspects of this entire crisis is that it reveals a structural flaw in U.S. politics insofar as many of the most stalwart supporters of Mr. Obama, I'm speaking of the population of African descent, as a result of the concessions that was received by that community some decades ago, that led to a retreat from Jim Crow, they basically made a de facto bargain to steer clear of foreign policy. And so you don't have many of our black leaders or even black intellectuals speaking out about a crisis that could be the trigger for a larger war involving the United States and Russia and NATO. And because they don't speak out, that strengthens the right-wing forces and gives them more sway and helps to steer the entire situation to a very dangerous precipice.
Let me ask you this. The forces that are controlling the Ukraine at the moment are there's an element of anti-black or African racism. There's anti-Semitism. There's homophobia. I understand that there was the voice of the Ukraine was an African. Well, she's Ukrainian, but one of her parents is from Africa, and the other parent is Ukrainian, is a Ukraine, and she was basically told that she was not, you know, really representing. She wasn't a Ukrainian, and she basically said she was, and they have been real anti-Jewish, anti-Semitic wave of anti-Semitism, as well as a lot of just outright anti-gay statements, and the people leading these demonstrations have been accused of all of those things. Is that correct?
That is correct. And in some ways, the crisis in Ukraine has the earmarks of the crisis in Syria. That is to say, in Syria, as is well known, the U.S. and its NATO allies are playing ball with al-Nusra Front and other formations that are very close to al-Qaeda, even though we are told repeatedly and repetitively that the North Atlantic countries are opposed to al-Qaeda. One can draw one or two conclusions. One conclusion might be that they feel that these ultra-right-wing forces can do the dirty work and then be swept from the stage of power, and more amenable forces can be brought into play at that point. Or you can come to the conclusion that they are well aware that these are ultra-right-wing forces. They don't intend for them to be swept from the stage, and they have a scenario planned where these ultra-right-wing forces will conduct the dirtiest of dirty work. Now, you can apply that also to the Ukraine. That is to say, one can speculate that the NATO countries would like the right sector and Svoboda to do their dirty work and then be swept from the stage, or they expect them to do their dirty work ad infinitum. In any case, it's a very dangerous scenario that's unfolding.
Now, I'm speaking with Dr. Gerald Horn, author of Black Revolutionary William Patterson and the Globalization of the African-American Freedom Struggle. Now, I wanted you to elaborate on the whole question of, I know you have maintained for many years that a certain sector of the African petty bourgeoisie inside the United States basically won't talk about international politics because they made a deal to basically be quiet for, you know, the limited freedoms that we as African people in the United States have supposedly received. But could you talk about some Chokwe Lumumba just passed away. He was the head of the mayor of Jackson, Mississippi. And, you know, you had the Black Panther Party, the League of Revolutionary Black Workers. Could you just basically talk about some of the black organizations that attempted to keep the international struggle going?
Well, you know, I knew Chokwe Lumumba. We worked shoulder to shoulder in the National Conference of Black Lawyers. And as you know, he was a leading cadre in the Republic of New Africa, and that's one of the reasons he wound up in Mississippi. And one of the things that struck me about him was his utter and total disrespect for the judiciary in the United States. At least in this country, it's routine for lawyers to stand when the judge enters the courtroom and to address him as Your Honor, as he might be, or she might be addressed as Your Worship in
Canada,
the British Commonwealth countries.
Right.
But he might be prone, for example, to curse the judge to the courtroom. This was a political statement because in many ways he didn't accept the sovereignty of the United States of America. So his passing away was a grievous loss.
Now, can you stay on until after 12? Is that possible?
Well, you know, I'm going to catch a flight.
Oh, okay. All right. So let's. Can we move on? There's another. We lost Lee Lorch. Did you hear that?
Yes, and you know, I knew Lee Lorch. Lee Lorch was an anti-racist crusader. First of all, in New York City, where he campaigned against the segregation of Stuyvesant Town, a new housing development that was built in Manhattan about 65-odd years ago and was destined to be segregated and racially until people like Lee Lorch began to campaign. And then he wound up in Arkansas where he was a teacher at Philander Smith College and got involved in the desegregation battle and was catapulted on the front pages of national and international headlines because he was one of the few Euro-Americans who stood tall against the racist mobs who were attacking black school children seeking to desegregate Little Rock High School, Central High School. And as a result, he wound up going into exile in Canada, seeking refuge like so many have before or since. And I understand just passed away. How old was he when he passed away?
I believe Lee was 96. And Lee Lorch, we work with Lee Lorch on the, speaking of Paul Robeson, on the centenary of Paul Robeson. We work with him. We had a coalition up here, and Lee Lorch was a leading member of that coalition. We met at Charles Roach's office. That's where we had held our meetings, and Lee Lorch was, I was in contact with him. Selwyn McLean went to see him the day before he passed away, and was, I went to see him the day he passed away, and he died the night before. So we stayed in contact with Lee Lorch because he was very close to the many of us in the African and Caribbean community in Toronto.
Mm-hmm. Well, you will be sorely missed.
Most definitely. Now, Venezuela, we have about 10 minutes left, and the corporate media has been silent on Venezuela. Now, I understand the real news. I've been looking at the real. I've been following the real news. They've been talking about it. Amy Goodman, I think, has been talking about it. But what is? Why do you feel they're not talking about it? And what is actually taking place as we speak?
Well, what's taking place, even as the New York Times concedes this morning, is that many of the elite forces, the upper-class forces, the upper-middle-class forces in Venezuela, in Caracas in particular, are trying to dislodge the successor to the late Hugo Chavez as president. I'm speaking of Nicolas Maduro. One of the aspects of this struggle is that retailers, those who control the distribution of food, for example, have been creating artificial shortages, which is leading to long lines in grocery stores, which obviously is exacerbating the temper and temperament of many ordinary Venezuelans. There have been raucous demonstrations in the streets that the Maduro regime has blamed in part on activities by the U.S. Embassy, and that led to the expulsion of a number of members of the U.S. Embassy just a few days ago. It reminds me of the anecdote, which goes like this. Why is it that there seems to be a greater amount of political stability in the United States than the rest of Latin America and the rest of the Caribbean? And the answer is there's no U.S. Embassy in Washington, D.C. And this bespeaks this very interventionist role, if you like, that the U.S. Embassy has been playing in Venezuela internal affairs, not least because Venezuela is seen as a stepping stone to destabilizing Cuba, and Venezuela is providing subsidized petroleum throughout the hemisphere to Haiti, to other CARICOM members, that is to say Caribbean community members, to Nicaragua. It has close relations with Brazil. You know that these countries, the Latin American Caribbean countries, held a very important meeting in Havana just a few weeks ago where the United States and Canada were pointedly excluded.
Right.
And this formation is seen as something of a replacement for the Washington-headquartered, Washington-dominated Organization of American
in
States.
The States, right.
All of this is seen with consternation and concern in North America in particular, and that helps to shed light upon their destabilizing role in Caracas, speaking of the destabilizing role of the United States in particular.
All right, I'm going to ask you one last question about China and Japan now. Leaders across Asia say that we should use the 70th anniversary of the end of World War II to build more peaceful, a more peaceful future. Now, this is going against the grain of imperialists. They would really love to see China and Korea and China and Japan basically duke it out with one another, don't you think?
Well, yes, in a sense. I think that the United States in particular would like to see a conflict between China and Japan, because that would knock out the number two and number three economic forces on this small planet. Although I should mention that of late there has been growing concern in Washington about the militarization of Japan. Memories are still fresh about World War II and the ferocious fighting power of the Japanese military. And the kinds of right-wing militarism as reflected in the Shinzo Abe regime is on the one hand seen as very useful as a way to target China, but on the other hand, there is justifiable and legitimate concern that that could backfire. I mean, this brings us full circle, if you like, to Ukraine and Syria, for example, where there is an attempt to use these ultra-right forces to do the dirty work of the United States and its NATO allies. But as the tragic events of September 11, 2001 tend to suggest, these forces can blow up in the faces, quite literally, of their allies and erstwhile creators.
Now, this whole question of the Ukraine, I guess you are talking about it. Probably Didon Kimathi, maybe Walter Turner. Who else in the United States coming from the black radical tradition, the African People's Socialist Party's, the Burning Spear? I work with them. I wanted to see what they're going to say about that. But what do you think? Who has responded from our community in terms of on the Ukrainian question?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, I did a talk with Glenn Ford for his Black Agenda report about this question yesterday, and we talked at length about it. I assume it'll be reflected in Black Agenda report. But other than that, I'm not in a position to say with more specificity, although I can say with confidence on a level of generalization, that there's been a strange muteness, a strange quiet about this burning crisis that has the potential to spin out of control and consume the lives of hundreds, if not thousands, of innocents.
The final call hasn't done anything?
Oh, I'm sure they will. As a matter of fact, I'm surprised they haven't called me about it.
Right. All right, so is there anything else you'd like to add, or we'll wait until next week because we have a whole...
Yeah.
We have a bunch of elections to talk about in South Africa and India, Brazil, and so on and so forth.
I guess we'll have to hold that off until next week.
That sounds good. I appreciate it, and we apologize for that technical glitch, but try to make sure that it doesn't happen again.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Take care.
Bye-bye.